The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Ellis Wax Lecture at the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Esther Wax Book, and I am Ellis Wax's daughter. My father loved history, and he was particularly interested in the relationship between Jefferson and Adams, so he would have been extremely excited about this event. It's now my pleasure to introduce award-winning author, scholar, historian, and one of my favorite college professors, Gordon Wood. We love him at Brown, so I know everyone here is in for a treat tonight. The New York Times said that Professor Wood is more than an American historian. He is almost an American institution. His book, The Radicalism of the American Revolution, won him the Pulitzer Prize for History and the Ralph Waldo Emerson Award. He has received awards for his works about Benjamin Franklin, the Founding Fathers, and early American history. In 2011, President Obama awarded him a National Humanities Medal. A frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New Republic, he is the Alva O. Way Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. He also previously taught at other schools like Harvard and the University of Michigan. Professor Wood's latest book, Friends Divided, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, is a biography of two very different founding fathers whose intertwined fortunes and philosophies helped define America. Noted presidential historian Ron Chernow of Hamilton fame said, "Whenever I read Gordon Wood, the dean of 18th century American historians, I feel as if I'm absorbing wisdom at the feet of the master." Friends Divided is teeming with exceptionally acute and unvarnished insights into Thomas Jefferson and John Adams as they do battle for the nation's soul. The New York Times calls the book an engrossing story, which Wood tells with a mastery of detail. My family and I are very pleased to have the esteemed professor with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Gordon S. Wood.
Thank you, Esther. It's always good to have a former student introduce you. You get a much better introduction than you deserve. Well, I'm delighted to be back here at this marvelous institution. You folks from Philadelphia don't know how lucky you are to have such a place, and I'm delighted. Well, this is a story about these two men, John Adams and Jefferson, who died on the same day, as perhaps you know, July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years after the Declaration of 1776 was written, a jubilee celebration of that document. It was such a marvelous coincidence that the nation couldn't help but believe it was providential. This coincidence alone, I think, has linked these two men forever after in our consciousness. But of course, our memory and our celebration of the two patriots has differed greatly. Until recently, Jefferson has dominated our historical memory. We are continually asking ourselves whether Jefferson still survives or what is still living in the ideas of Jefferson, and we quote him on every side of every issue in our history. I think no figure in our past has embodied so many of our hopes, so much of our heritage. Most Americans think of Jefferson much as our first professional biographer, James Parton, did. If Jefferson was wrong, wrote Parton in 1874, America is wrong. If America is right, Jefferson was right. Now, no one says that about John Adams. Indeed, until recently, few Americans paid much attention to Adams. And even now, the two men command very different degrees of affection and attention as founders. While Jefferson has hundreds, if not thousands, of monographs, books devoted to every aspect of his wide-ranging life, Adams has relatively few works written about him, and with many of these focusing on his apparently archaic political theory. Jefferson's mountaintop home, Monticello, has become a World Heritage Site, visited every year by hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world. By contrast, Adams's modest home in Quincy, Massachusetts, maintained by the National Park Service, is very hard to get to and receives only a small fraction of the hundreds of thousands who go to Monticello. Jefferson has a huge memorial dedicated to him located on the tidal basin right off the mall in Washington. Adams has no monument in the nation's capital, and those who would like to erect one have struggled for decades without success. In 1776, no American could have predicted that the reputations of Adams and Jefferson would so diverge. Indeed, at the time of independence, Adams was by far the more well-known of the two. And no one contributed more to the drive for independence than did Adams. Jefferson admired Adams. He was his senior by about 8 years, and he shared his passion for American independence. The two revolutionaries soon became good friends. During their missions abroad in the 1780s, their friendship was enriched and deepened. Then the French Revolution and partisan politics of the 1790s strained that relationship. In 1796, Vice President Adams succeeded Washington as president, with Jefferson elected as vice president. Adams assumed that he, like Washington, would be reelected to a second term, when after a very bitter campaign in 1800, Jefferson defeated Adams for the presidency, and Adams was humiliated, and the break between the two former friends seemed irreparable. Adams was so angry, so bitter, that he refused to attend the inauguration of his successor, the only president in our history who has not attended his successor's inauguration. Actually, when you look at the two men, it's amazing that they became friends. No doubt they had some things in common that I mentioned. They both were members of the Continental Congress, ministers abroad, both became president and vice president. And they agreed on the rightness of resisting Great Britain. What I think they really bound them together was their deep, bitter hatred of Alexander Hamilton. But despite all that, they were very different from one another, almost inconceivable that they should have become friends. They were divided in almost every fundamental way, in temperament, in their ideas of government, in their assumptions of human nature, in their notions of society, in their attitude toward religion, in the conception of America. In fact, in every single thing that matters, they differed from one another. Of course, they were physically very different. A virtual Mutton Jeff, well, that probably dates me. There's some people here probably who know who Mutton Jeff are, but Jefferson was perhaps 6'2" or so, tall, lean, gangly. He had a reddish, freckled complexion, bright hazel eyes, and a reddish blonde hair, which he tended to wear unpowdered in a queue. He bowed to everybody he met, and he usually talked with his arms folded, a sign, I think, of his very reserved nature. By contrast, Adams was short, 5'7 or so, and stout. By my physical constitution, he admitted, I am but an ordinary man. He had sharp blue eyes, and he often covered his thinning light brown hair with a wig. William McClay, the caustic Scotch-Irish senator from Western Pennsylvania, had few kind words for anybody in his journal, but he was especially contemptuous of Adams, who was vice president of the new federal government and in 1789, and thus president of the Senate, and an active president of the Senate. He engaged in a debate with the other senators. Adams, wrote McClay, was a childish man, wrapped up with a very silly kind of laugh, who was usually wrapped up in the contemplation of his own importance. Whenever he looked at Adams presiding in his chair with his wig and small sword, McClay said he could not help thinking of a monkey just put into breeches. Now, there's no doubt that Adams could look like, could sometimes appear ridiculous in the eyes of others. That was never true of Jefferson. Although Jefferson was often hated and ridiculed in print by his political enemies, no one mocked him or made fun of him in quite the way they did Adams. Jefferson possessed a dignity that Adams lacked. Indeed, for many, Jefferson was the model, the very model of an 18th century gentleman, learned, genteel, possessing perfect self-control and serenity of spirit. Adams's temperament could not have been more different. He was high-strung, irascible. He had no serenity of spirit whatsoever. And to his great regret, he lacked what he called the gift of silence, something possessed by both Jefferson and George Washington. Whereas in the Continental Congress, Adams was always on his feet, debating, arguing, pushing his colleagues toward independence, Jefferson rarely said anything publicly. He was very effective, however, in small groups. Jefferson hated personal confrontations and valued politeness, treating even his enemies with grace and courtesy. In fact, I think his extreme politeness, his sensitivity to the feelings of others, and his keen desire not to offend was the secret of much of his political success in life. But since his polite words and his good-humored behavior to people could never be an accurate expression of his real feelings, he was always open to accusations of duplicity and deceit, of being two-faced. Adams, of course, was the opposite. He was excitable. He had a little of Jefferson's sense of restraint. He was, as his physician friend, Dr. Benjamin Rush, described him, fearless of men and of the consequences of a bold assertion of opinion in all his speeches. He had a sharp, sarcastic tongue, and he used it often, sometimes in the presence of the recipient of his derision. In the Congress in 1777, he even publicly took on what he called the veneration which is being paid to General Washington. Adams was not taken with politeness and with hiding his feelings. He was, as Rush put it, a stranger to dissimulation, the very characteristic Jefferson was often accused of having. Jefferson was reserved and tended to use his good manners and relaxed cordiality to keep people at a distance. Adams was different. Familiarity with acquaintances tended to breed amiability. In 1787, his Harvard classmate, Jonathan Sewall, who had become a loyalist, met Adams in London and was reminded of the appeal Adams had once had for him. Adams, he told a judge back in Massachusetts, has a heart formed for friendship and susceptible of its finest feelings. He is humane, generous, and open, warm to friendly attachments, though perhaps rather implacable to those he thinks his enemies. Once Adams felt at ease with someone, he could be much more jovial and open than Jefferson, more familiar and more revealing of his feelings. As Sewall suggested, people who got to know him well found him utterly likable. His candor and his unvarnished honesty won their hearts. But these qualities of forthrightness did not work well in public. Adams never quite learned to tailor his remarks to his audience in the way Jefferson did. Consequently, he lacked Jefferson's suave and expert political skills. Now, the two men had even more fundamental differences than ones I've just suggested. Jefferson was an aristocratic Virginia planter, a well-connected slaveholder, a patriarch, as he called himself, reared in a hierarchical slaveholding society. He inherited land and slaves from his father, and he acquired more land and more slaves from his father-in-law. By the early 1770s, he had become one of the wealthiest planters in the whole colony of Virginia. Although there was no one in America who knew more about more things than Jefferson, it was not his obvious intelligence, his obvious learning that catapulted him into membership in the House of Burgesses of Virginia. His political position flowed naturally from his wealth and his social eminence. Now, by contrast, Adams was middling born in a Massachusetts society that was far more egalitarian than anything, any society in the South. Adams had few connections outside of his town of Braintree, and his rise was due almost exclusively to merit, to his intelligence, his learning, and his hard work as a lawyer. By the early 1770s, he had become the busiest lawyer in the colony of Massachusetts, and in many eyes, the most respected for the breadth and depth of his legal and historical knowledge. Most of his wealth, such as it was acquired from his law practice. He became reasonably well off from his legal career, but he never became one of the wealthiest members of Massachusetts. And that was something that always rankled him. But even more important than these differences, I think, were the political differences between the two men. Jefferson was a radical 18th century style liberal who was as extreme in his views as an elected politician could be in the 18th century. In his attitude towards government, especially the federal government, he did not resemble a modern liberal. He was convinced that people were naturally sociable. If only the government, particularly monarchical government, got out of the way and allowed the natural flow of sociability to touch people, connect them. He believed in the least government possible. This was, of course, the progressive position at the time, shared by Thomas Paine, William Godwin, the founder of anarchism, and other radicals. Small government, in other words, was what was radical. Instead of the strong, modern, and integrated fiscal military state that Alexander Hamilton and other Federalists wanted to create, Jefferson, as he said in his inaugural address, sought only a wise and frugal government, one that kept its citizens from injuring one another, but otherwise left them free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement. All the government responsibilities he wanted, the principal care of our persons, our property, and our reputation, constituting the grand feeling, grand field of human concerns, he said, all of those were to be left to the states. The national government was to not have any great responsibilities. In fact, if under his presidency, you wouldn't know you were living in a federal government except for the delivery of the mail. Now, like most liberals at the time, Jefferson had a magnanimous view of human nature. He believed literally in what he wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. In his case, only all white men. And that the obvious differences among individuals, as they became adults, were due to the effects of the environment. In other words, nurture, not nature, was all important to Jefferson and to most other Americans. I think they shared that assumption that all men, and I think we still do as Americans, we really do believe that the differences that we see around us, of course, are due to different environments, different training, different levels of education. And as a consequence, Jefferson put an enormous emphasis on education. Like other liberals, Jefferson was optimistic and confident of the future. He was a virtual Pollyanna about everything. His expectations always outran reality. He was the pure American innocent. He had little understanding of man's capacity for evil, and he had no tragic sense whatsoever. That is, he had no sense of the limitations of life, no sense of people being constrained by circumstances over which they had little or no control. I think this is amazing, given the fact that he was a slaveholder who hated slavery, but claimed he could do little about it. Jefferson thought that educated Americans would choose as its leaders only natural aristocrats, virtuous and talented men like himself. He believed that the world was getting better, becoming freer, more democratic, and that the new Republic of the United States had a special role to play in fulfilling that future. America, he said, was a chosen country and the world's best hope. It was Jefferson who invented the idea of American exceptionalism. Despising monarchy, he became a true believer in the Republican revolutions that he hoped would spread everywhere in the world. His support for the French Revolution was unbounded and was worth all the bloodshed, all the lives lost in its name. If only an Adam and Eve were left alive in every country, but left free, he wrote in 1793, it would be better than it is now. The Federalist John Adams was very different. He was a conservative, perhaps the most conservative president we've ever had. Russell Kirk, in his influential book, The Conservative Mind, considered Adams to be the founder of true conservatism in America. That book, I think, came out in 1952. But Adams was anything but a Ronald Reagan-type conservative. He had a sour and cynical view of human nature. He was pessimistic about the future and a severe critic of the Jeffersonian conception of American exceptionalism. Adams said over and over again, America was no different from other countries. We were just as vicious, just as sinful, just as corrupt as other nations. There was, he said, no special providence for the United States. Indeed, Adams was the ultimate realist, committed to what he called stubborn facts. He challenged every American dream, every American myth, especially the belief that all men are created equal. He believed that the opposite. He believed that all men were born unequal, and that education could not do much about the inherent differences among people. He didn't know about DNA and genes, of course, but he certainly was convinced that nature, not nurture, was what mattered. He told Jefferson that he had visited a foundling's hospital in France and had observed babies who were only 4 days old and was struck by the great inequalities among these babies. Some were ugly, others beautiful. Some were stupid, others smart, he said. They were all born to equal rights, he admitted, but to very different fortunes, to very different degrees of success and influence in life. Society, he said, was inherently unequal, and unlike Jefferson, he believed that the aristocrats who would inevitably rise to the top in America, the 1% or the 10%, whatever, the elites, as we call them, would not necessarily be the best and wisest men. They were more apt to be the richest, the most attractive, the most ambitious, and the wiliest. Adams did not disparage big government as Jefferson did, but he did fear the unrestrained power of government. Actually, Adams made much more of a contribution, I think, to American constitutionalism than any other founder. His pamphlet, Thoughts on Government, written in 1776, decisively influenced the revolutionary constitution making in the states in 1776. It was he who ensured that our constitutions would have a separation of powers. He also wanted the executives to have an absolute veto over all legislation. Now, in 1776, no state agreed with him. No, even his own colleagues in Massachusetts didn't agree. But in 1779, 1780, he drafted the Massachusetts Constitution and urged, once again, an absolute veto for the governor. It was, again, too much for his colleagues, but they accepted the idea of the veto, only it was a limited veto. And, of course, that stuck. And other states soon picked it up. And, of course, when the Federal Convention met in Philadelphia, they followed the Massachusetts model and created a president that has a veto, not a complete veto, but a limited veto. It's Matt Adams who created that model. He had much more of an impact, I think, over the new Constitution, the federal Constitution, than even James Madison, even though he was abroad when the Constitution and the convention met, when the Constitution was drafted. In perhaps the most profound statement he ever made, and surely his greatest contribution to our understanding of government, he declared that power was never to be trusted without a check. Adams had little confidence in democracy and in the virtue of the American people, and consequently he was willing to borrow some of the elements of the English monarchy to offset the populism of American republicanism. He was a great admirer of the English Constitution, the finest in the world, he said. Since he believed that England was a republic, a monarchical republic, no doubt, but still a republic, he had difficulty relating his ideas to his fellow Americans. Most of them just simply could not understand what he was talking about when he called England, which had a king, a republic. Adams thought that sooner or later America's elections, and this I think is timely, America's elections become so partisan, so corrupt, that we would have to turn to having our office holders serve for life. Eventually, he said, we would have to follow the example of England and make the president and the Senate hereditary to escape from the corruption of elections. I don't know if we're at that point yet, but he would certainly appreciate the problem we're going through. Despite these obvious differences between these two men, however, there were bonds of friendship that ultimately made their reconciliation possible, although it took a long time. In 1812, as Adams's passions, partisan passions, faded, their earlier friendship was painstakingly, it took them 2 years, by Benjamin Rush, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who knew both men, Adams better than Jefferson, to bring the two men back together. Rush admired both men and believed that the nation and posterity required the reconciliation of these two great patriot leaders. Over the next 14 years, Adams and Jefferson exchanged over 150 letters, with Adams writing three times as many as Jefferson. Now, that's understandable. At one point, Adams says, well, how many correspondence do you have? How many letters did you get last year? And Jefferson replied, he says, oh, 2,000 and something. And Adams was shocked. He says, I only have 200 and something. So 10 times as many letters, which meant that Jefferson tried to answer every one of them. He was different. He was in a different league, celebrity league. He's corresponding with scientists all over the world, with the Tsar of Russia. Adams had nothing like that. Adams was in a totally different, lesser league. Although Madison, James Madison, who was Jefferson's close friend, could never understand what Jefferson saw in Adams. Jefferson realized that Adams was a man, as he said, of rigorous honesty and realistic judgment. He claimed that once you broke through his crusty surface, the irascible Yankee was as warm and amiable as a person could be. And Jefferson tolerated better than most Adams's facetious and teasing manner. That was his way. He loved to tease. He loved to razz people. Here's an example. In 1815, you know, Napoleon's defeated. The Bourbons are back on the throne of France. And Adams, who hated the French Revolution and knew Jefferson, loved it. Adams couldn't help ribbing Jefferson. What do you think of the French Revolution now, Mr. Jefferson, he writes. Polite as always, Jefferson suffered all this razzing in good humor. The two men valued their correspondence too much to endanger it, and thus they tended to avoid controversial subjects, especially slavery. They did touch on it in 1819-20 when the Missouri crisis broke out, but they didn't push it very far. They were always polite to one another and had been always polite personally, even though their enemies or their followers had attacked them. They knew that their combination of idealism and realism had helped bring the nation together, and that realization, I think, was enough to sustain the revival of their friendship. But Adams always knew that it was an unequal relationship. He always knew that he would never have the acclaim from his fellow Americans that Jefferson had, and that Jefferson would continue to have. Adams may have been honest and realistic, telling us Americans what we needed to know, truths about ourselves that are difficult, if not impossible, to bear. But however true, however correct, however in accord with stubborn facts Adams's ideas and statements may have been, they were incapable and are incapable of inspiring and sustaining the United States, or any nation, I think, for that matter. Adams even doubted whether America could be a real nation. In America, he said, there was nothing like the patria of the Romans, the fatherland of the Dutch, or the patrie of the French. All he can see in America was an appalling diversity of religious denominations and ethnicities. In 1813, he counted at least 19 different religious sects in the country. We are such a hodgepodge of people, he concluded, such an omnium gatherum of English, Irish, German, Dutch, Swedes, French, etc., that it is difficult to give a name to the country characteristic of the people. By contrast, Jefferson's ideas, his statements, could and did inspire and nourish the diverse peoples of the United States. Despite, or perhaps because of his innocence and naive optimism, he offered his fellow Americans a set of stirring ideals that has carried our country through all of its many, many ordeals. Ezekiel Niles, who was the most prominent journalist of the early 19th century, knew the importance of Jefferson. He wanted to help establish a national character for Americans. And despite the victory over Britain in the War of 1812, Niles knew that eliminating the old English habits of mind was essential to establishing that national character. If we were to have a new nation, Niles declared in a public appeal that he wrote to Jefferson in his weekly journal in 1817, we needed new principles, new ideas, new ways of thinking. We seek a new revolution, not less important, perhaps, in its consequence than that of 1776, a revolution in letters, a shaking off of the fetters of the mind. To do this, he said, we must begin with the establishment of first principles, which were best found in the Declaration of Independence. Thus the Declaration, said Niles, shall be the best, the base of all the rest, the common reference in cases of doubt and difficulty. Now, Abraham Lincoln probably never saw Niles' appeal to Jefferson, but he had the same insight. When he said in 1858, on the eve of the Civil War, all honor to Jefferson, he paid homage to the one founder who he knew could explain why the breakup of the Union could not be allowed and why so many lives had to be sacrificed to maintain that Union. Lincoln knew what the Revolution had been about and what it implied, not just for Americans, but for all humanity, because Jefferson had told him so. The United States was a new Republican nation in a world of monarchies. And this is when he's speaking in the aftermath of the failure of the 1848 revolutions in Europe, where all Republican revolutions were put down and monarchy was all back in the saddle again. So that when Lincoln talks about we are the last best hope, he was literally true. All attempts at republicanism or democracy had failed, and we were the only republic left in the world, a grand experiment in self-government. Half the American people, said Lincoln in 1858, half had no direct blood connection to the founders of the nation. These German, Irish, French, and Scandinavian citizens either had come from Europe themselves or their ancestors had, and they had settled in America, finding themselves our equals in all things. Although these immigrants may have had no actual connection in blood with the revolutionary generation that could make them feel part of the rest of the nation, they had, said Lincoln, that old Declaration of Independence with this expression of the moral principle of equality to draw upon. This moral principle, which was applicable, he said, to all men in all times, made all these different peoples one with the founders. And then he goes on with an image that still boggles the mind. As though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the men who wrote that declaration. This emphasis on liberty, and then he shifts his metaphor, this emphasis on liberty and equality was the electric cord that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together, that will link these patriotic hearts as long as the love of freedom exists in the minds of men throughout the world. He's found a solution in Jefferson for what must have seemed to be an extraordinary, we take for granted, extraordinary mixture of people, even as early as 1850s. The diversity of America must have seemed to many people, how can a nation have so many different kinds of people? And Lincoln is grappling with that problem. He could never have invoked Adams, of course, on behalf of his cause. Adams was too ornery, too contrarian, too cynical, too realistic, perhaps, to offer any support for America's nationhood. Adams had no answer for the great problem of American diversity, how the great variety of individuals in America, with all their different ethnicities, their different races, their different religions, could be brought together into one nation. Jefferson did have an answer. As Lincoln grasped better than anyone, Jefferson offered Americans a set of beliefs that through the generations have applied a bond that I think holds together what is certainly the most diverse nation that history's ever known. Since now the whole world lives in the United States, nothing but Jefferson's ideals can turn such an assortment of different individuals into the one people that the Declaration says we are. To be an American is not to be someone, but to believe in something. And that something is what Jefferson declared. That's why we honor Jefferson and not Adams. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I'd be happy to answer questions. Yes, sir, over there.
I need some education. You said that when Lincoln made the point about being the last best hope of democracy, that would have been in the 1850s. What about the South American republics? Weren't they republics?
Well, they had broken away, and they were republics. They were already, as Jefferson said at one point, dictatorships, military takeovers, not real republics, and they were very despairing of their success. He thought sooner or later, he says, I wish them well, but I don't have much confidence. Adams, of course, because they were Roman Catholics, he being a good Puritan New Englander, had no hope whatsoever for Latin America. They were not flourishing democracies in the 1850s. And it really is only in the last 50 years that we've seen Latin America with now a majority of democracies.
As a distinguished historian, and I think I'm right in saying an admirer of Jefferson, how do you handle revisionists or people who we might call presentism people when they look back at Jefferson and want to bring him down quite a few pegs because of his obvious support for and belief in slavery?
Right. Well, it's not easy. I don't think you have, to some extent, you realize that, especially as a young man, it took a lot of courage for him to speak out with his colleagues against slavery. He did that as a young man in the House of Burgesses and made proposals for ending slavery at the Continental Congress. He became much different as he aged. He was caught, as he said, with the wolf by his ears. He saw the dilemma. He's not very admirable in the way he handles slavery, because he's not entirely honest, and yet he's caught up in circumstances that are almost impossible to extricate himself. And he does turn down efforts by younger people. When a younger friend came and said, Mr. Jefferson, 1815 or so, speak out, now's the time. He said, no, I leave it to you younger people. Well, this younger man freed his slaves, picked up and went to Illinois, became governor of Illinois, and it could be done. Jefferson simply doesn't do that. And so as a person, in that respect, he's not very admirable. And I think we can condemn him. But he said things that transcend his life. And that, I think, is what we recognize. And we have to make a difference between what people were like as a human being, all of his frailties, and what he stood for. I don't think it takes away from the notion that all men are created equal, that he was a slaveholder who did not believe, actually, that all men are created equal. He has a long section in his notes on the state of Virginia talking about black inequality, which most Americans, even his fellow Southerners, did not accept. Many of them were such environmentalists that they thought that the blackness of the African came from being scorched by the African sun. And then when they came to a more temperate climate, it might take generations, they would gradually whiten. And that was widely held by many. So Jefferson is a flawed human being and not actually very admirable when you get to know him. But at the same time, he said things that are so important to us and that transcend his flawed life. His last years, he becomes very much of a fire-eating Southerner. There's some things he says that aren't much different from a fire-eating Southerner of the 1850s. In his fear of the federal consolidation, a fear of government coming in, because he realizes if You know, he's very much opposed. He doesn't tell John Adams this, but he's very much opposed to what John Quincy Adams wants to do when John Quincy Adams becomes president in 1824. Adams has all kinds of ideas for internal improvements, you know, fixing the roads and canals, bring jobs to America, that kind of thing. Jefferson and other Southerners are frightened to death of this proposal because they see this, if the federal government can do that, then of course the federal government can do something about slavery. And that's always the fear they have, that the federal government, the Congress, is going to interfere with their domestic institution. So he becomes really a deep opponent of the nationalization of the culture, opposed deeply to what the Supreme Court was doing, the Marshall Court was doing in solidifying the strength of the federal government. So he's not a very appealing figure at the end because he's indistinguishable from his many of his colleagues. Even Madison is much more liberal than Jefferson at the end of his life and far more willing to accept the court, for example, than Jefferson. But I think you have to draw a distinction. I think it is important that we believe that all men are created equal. I think that declaration, Lincoln was absolutely right. It is the saving grace of our nation that we believe that and work and implement it. With the amount of money and effort that we put into education is based on that vision. And so I think Lincoln was absolutely right when he said all honor to Jefferson. But that's a long-winded answer to your question. There's no doubt that Jefferson is in younger years, he's courageous, takes stands that none of his colleagues took. But in his later years, he becomes quite narrow and I think less liberal than some of his other colleagues, like Madison.
You describe Jefferson's character as being rather genial, optimistic. Did the death of his wife change his character, his personality in any way?
I don't think it changed his character or his personality. He was devastated by the death of his wife. He was only 39. They had been married only 10 years. She died in the aftermath of weakened by childbirth. She had very tough times with children surviving. Only two girls survived to adulthood. He certainly went into a deep depression for 6 weeks or so. I mean, he just apparently cut himself loose and was only gradually brought back to reality and getting involved in politics once again. His wife presumably promised him that not to remarry. He's only 39, which helps to explain why he might have taken a concubine in the Sally Hemings case, because he also said at one point that the most powerful passion, of course, was the sex drive. And here he is, a 39-year-old man, who had presumably promised his wife not to remarry. Most widowers, and there were far more widowers in the 18th century than there are now, because childbirth was difficult and was deadly. Many men went through buried two or three wives in their lifetime. He presumably promised never to remarry. So that makes that's the context for the concubine, and the Hemings. I do accept the Gordon Reed's argument, which is very persuasive, but I don't see it as a love relationship. He shows no affection towards Sally or his offspring, which is unlike many of the, of course, this went on with other planters as well, and they often had paid some attention to these offspring, giving them presents at Christmas or at least acknowledging their existence. He does no such thing. He enters the birth of these children, slave born of Sally Hemings, in his farm book, along with the birth of a new calf or a new heifer or a new pig or something. He has no affection whatsoever for the children or for her. So it was a very strange relationship, but not uncommon, I guess, among, at least contemporaries say that, not uncommon among these planters in the 18th century and early 19th century.
So you know in Hamilton what King George has to say about John Adams.
In the show,
in
you mean?
In the show, yeah.
Yeah, repeat. I've seen the show, but tell me what...
John Adams, good luck. That's what King George says when he
about good luck, did he say?
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they presumably were, you know, Adams was the first minister to the court of St. James. And apparently, where Jefferson comes over to visit, he's the minister to France. And Adams presents his friend, and, you know, he's a minister, to the king, and the king turned at the court, and the king turns his back on the two of them. That's the story that was told. George had a hard time accepting these American cousins breaking away. It really was difficult. Although Adams's account of his interview with George III, he said all the right things to, because he admired the English, and he admired the English Constitution, so he could say to them with real sincerity how much he admired the mother country, the former mother country. And George said, I support my own country, and George apparently was touched by this and said, I would expect nothing else but support for your own country. But two of them both hated Hamilton, of course, so they would not have liked the show.
Would you care to comment on the difference between your interpretation and David McCulloch's interpretation of the friendship and the split between these two?
Well, if I reviewed David's book, which is a marvelous book. It's really a story of a marriage. And and I reviewed it favorably in the New York Review of Books. I can't remember exactly where I would differ. I mean, he admires Adams. He doesn't say anything about his. He really doesn't penetrate into Adams's belief in inequality, for example, and in his. He doesn't emphasize the way in which he took on Jefferson's belief in American exceptionalism. He's kinder to Adams in that respect. And I think in some things he simply took Adams at his own word. For example, Adams defended the soldiers in the Boston Massacre and thinks of himself later, he talks about what a courageous stand I took in defending these soldiers who had killed, you know, the five people, the citizens, in the massacre. But it's a little more complicated than that because Josiah Quincy, who was same age as Adams and was the other leading attorney in the town of Boston in 1770s, and the two of them were the co-defending attorneys of the soldiers. And we have some evidence. Adams, of course, says nothing in his autobiography or his diary about the reality of the defense. But Quincy does, and we have a letter from his father who is outraged that his son is taking on the defense of these terrible soldiers, these killers. And he says, what are you doing? You're going to destroy your legal practice. People will be so upset that you're doing this. You're going to be like a Tory, a loyalist. You're just taking the wrong thing. And Josiah Quincy writes back, cool it, Dad. He says, look, I'm doing this because I was asked by Samuel Adams et al. All of the Patriot leaders of Boston asked Adams and Quincy to take the two leading attorneys in the town to take on the defense of the soldiers. It turns out that the radicals were upset that the reputation of Boston in the empire was being hurt, as if we were sort of a wild, crazy place, sort of like Dallas after the Kennedy assassination, and they wanted to redress that, and so it's a setup. He didn't lose any clients. Neither of the two lawyers hurt their practice one bit by taking that on. Well, that's something McCulloch doesn't deal with. He takes Adams as his. As I say, it's a great book about a marriage, and he captures that better than any other person. And of course, he is responsible because the book then led to the TV series, responsible, I think, for whatever attention Adams is getting now comes from David McCullough's book. So I think it's a great read.
Mr. Wood, where were Presidents Jefferson and President Adams educated at?
Well, Jefferson was educated at the College of William and Mary, and Adams was educated at Harvard. Both of them then were trained, apprenticed to law practice. Jefferson, like many planters, never took his law practice seriously. It was never going to be a source of income. He needed to have a little attention to the law, and he sort of, it was a kind of part-time thing for him. And as soon as he became, as soon as he inherited his father-in-law's land and slaves, he gave up the law practice, which he never much liked anyhow. Adams, on the other hand, was a real attorney. I mean, he lived by the law, and he toured everywhere. I mean, he was riding circuit. He loved the law. He loved it. The common law. He mastered it in a way that no one else could. That's why they used him. The radicals had, he'd become the, what's the word, consigliere of the radicals. He was their lawyer in the late 60s and early 70s in Boston. And he knew more law and more history than anyone else, and he loved it because he'd be in court and he'd pull out these precedents, these examples from the deep, deep medieval past that nobody in the court knew what to do with. And of course, he won a lot of cases just by that sheer knowledge. So they differed in that. Jefferson never really liked the law, and he begins to make fun of it, mocks it later. Adams never did.
Thank you so much for an outstanding commentary. Would you talk a bit more about Adams and the separation of powers? I happen to believe that that is the most important contribution coming out of the Revolutionary War period in terms of the legal aspects, and is a real reason why we have succeeded and other republics have failed. So talk a bit about why you favor Jefferson's rhetoric as opposed to the reality of separation of powers.
Well, I think a lot of political scientists might not agree with you because, you know, what separation of powers means is that this is what he suggested in his thoughts on government, that we do not allow members of the legislature to simultaneously hold office in the executive branch. Now, you know what that means? We can never have a parliamentary system. The English were stumbling towards that. They didn't know they were going to have the mid-19th century cabinet parliamentary system, which has actually become far more influential in the developed world than our system. We thought that that was a source of corruption, that ministers could appoint members of the legislature to offices in the executive and buy them off. You're buying off votes. We thought that was corruption. Adams thought it was corruption. But of course, that's the secret to the parliamentary system. The English system depends on the members of the cabinet, the executive, simultaneously holding office in the House of Lords or the House of Commons. We prevent that. Now, you can say, well, that's separation of powers, but it prevents us from having what is, after all, the form that exists in most of the developed countries of Europe and in the world. And it prevents the kind of loggerheads that we get and it leads to, generally speaking, leads to more compromise, more coalitions than we can ever have. So it might not be a good thing, but it is based on this fear of power, which I think is part and parcel of the American Revolution, the fear of unchecked power. And certainly Adams, if we're not going to have a parliamentary system, then maybe it's just as well we have this great fear of power. And he did make contributions to an independent judiciary. That was very important in his Massachusetts Constitution of 1780. He influenced constitution making. But separation of powers, which sounds so good, on the face of it, has that problem, will never have a parliamentary system. Some people, you know, political scientists have sometimes yearned for that. I think Woodrow Wilson talked about it. Wouldn't that be nice to be able to have the parliament or the Congress and the executive together without being at loggerheads? There are advantages to the parliamentary system that most countries have, most developed countries, and we don't have. So you can, but we're stuck. We're not going to ever change that.
Hi, can you talk a little bit about the Louisiana Purchase? And on the one hand, you have Jefferson, who is a small government guy, doubling the size of the country and inevitably making it, you know, creating more power for the executive. What would Adams have thought of that, or what did Adams think about that, and would he have ever endeavored to do that?
Well, I'm not sure I followed your question.
Thank you. I'm asking if Louisiana Purchase, yeah. Would Adams have pursued that?
Right. Adams and John Quincy Adams, his son, both favored it. They were outliers. Federalists in New England almost uniformly opposed the Louisiana Purchase because they said all they could think of was all these Republican Jeffersonian senators and congressmen coming out of the states that would be made out of the Louisiana Purchase. They just thought the country was going, it's just too big, we'll all fall apart. And there was a plot in 1805 by some New England Federalists to separate from the nation, create their own separate nation that would be more English. And they sort of had regrets that they had the revolution after all. But that alienated poor John Quincy, was elected to the Senate by the state legislature in those days as a Federalist. And he was kicked out by the Federalist-dominated Massachusetts legislature. So he became a Republican. He announces it, you know, openly. I'm going to become a Republican. And so Madison draws on him for minister abroad, and then finally brings him back. And then when Monroe takes over, who's also a Virginian Republican, he makes him Secretary of State. John Quincy is probably our most talented Secretary of State in our history, and he really writes the Monroe Doctrine and acquires the Floridas and the whole transcontinental treaty with Spain, which we were sort of taking over demographically because Spain was simply not capable of filling it with people. We were demographic imperialism was going on. But Adams, both Adamses were never really hardcore Federalists. And on these crucial issues like the acquisition of Louisiana or the embargo, John Quincy supported the embargo, which really infuriated New Englanders. And Adams, too, comes around to supporting a lot of the Republican measures. In fact, during the reconciliation, he writes to Jefferson. Adams was on the fringes. He's really not part of the aristocracy of Massachusetts, of New England. He writes and says, look, because I was president, I'm elected to all these boards and all these committees, you know, Agricultural Committee, American Academy of Arts and Sciences, all these committees in Massachusetts, and I'm always elected president, kind of figurehead president. He said, but I'm the only one who votes, who supports the Republicans. And he does this with a certain amount of humor. But he is on the outs with the Essex Junto. He resents these people because they look down on him. He's a middling. His origins were, you know, rather obscure, middling sort of background. He's never a wealthy man, and so he feels that it's part of his anger at the aristocracy. He always said to Jefferson, "You fear the one, the monarch. I fear the few, the aristocrats." And that separates him from many of his fellow Federalists. He really is alienated from his native Massachusetts. He gets along with them, but he knows they don't like him, and he doesn't like them. It's a mutual antipathy, right?
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your presentation. A couple of points. One is that I think the idea of separation of powers seems to echo the thinking of Ben Franklin, whose position was the idea of enlightenment was to give the common man control over their lives. So from that standpoint, separation of powers and balance of powers seem to make sense. Now, the other thing is that it's important to also contextualize the American Revolution in terms of enlightenment, this age of science, which goes back to Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and Newton. And Newton's, Locke, for instance, yes, that's, I'm getting to that question. So Locke had was very influential on Jefferson. Could you give us a sense of what Locke's influence was on Jefferson? Thank you.
Well, let's start with Locke. I mean, Locke is the great environmentalist, if you will. He's the one that's posited a blank slate, which gets etched by experience. And that's the personality that you develop. All men are created equal. We're all born with a single blank slate. And what differences that emerge, and no one denied the differences between adults, is due to the environments. That's a basic American tenet, I would say. Even in the face of DNA and genetic studies and a whole lot of other evidence, we cling to that belief. It's important that we believe that, even if it's wrong. Because that's the secret to our success, insofar as we have any, is that we believe that, we're devoted to that notion. And that's Jefferson's belief, and it's taken from Locke. And anything else leads you down to a road that we don't want to go. And we know that, and we resist that. Now, of course, they were living in enlightenment. This is what Jefferson, part of that enlightenment is the new centrality given to politeness, to civility. You have to understand the 17th century was a bloody century. 30 years war, religions, war, people killed by the hundreds of thousands. If they had modern weapons, they would have killed the millions. It would have been as bad as the 20th century. And all of a sudden, the 18th century is the coffee house century, and people are getting along, and there's sociability, and there's a sympathy for people. And when you believe that all men are created equal, and you committed to that, and the elite did commit themselves to that, then they feel morally responsible for those that are left behind, who are deprived, who are poor. The medieval people didn't care about the poor. They didn't care. They just said, well, they're like the cattle in the fields. What can you do about it? That's the way they're born. That's it. All of a sudden, in the 18th century, people are concerned. They have sympathy. They have empathy for people left behind because they believe that all men are created equal. That's so crucial to us in our world. We still live off of that enlightenment tenet. And therefore, you're concerned about people who are left behind. And you want to do something for them. You want to change their environment so that they will live fuller, richer lives. In the medieval world, the pre-modern world, who cared about them? They couldn't do anything about it. It was like talking about the animals in the field. Those people were poor. They'll always be poor, and they'll always be deprived. And what can you do about it? That's a monumental change. That's what we mean by modernity. And we're very much caught up in that. So that's part of the Enlightenment. And the politeness, the civility, comes from the feeling, look, we're living in a new world now in the 18th century, a coffeehouse world. That's what leads to Jefferson's belief in the social sense that every person have. Although he believed that in black inequality, he certainly believed that that all blacks had the same moral sense as whites, and they were all capable of sociability. That's why he believes that if you could just get the government out of the way, we have a natural flow of love for one another. And it's intervening institutions that prevent us from getting along. Those are really radical liberal views of the late 18th century. And that's what distinguishes Jefferson, say, from Adams. Most American leaders are Jeffersonians in that sense. That's the side that wins. And it's ironic that it should come from the South, that these Southern planters should be the Republicans. And the Northerners, Northern Yankees, are the ones who are, of course, Jefferson never lost an election in his life. And the Northern Federalists were frightened to death of democracy because they were losing elections. And so that's what explains the paradox. You have this liberal South of slaveholding planters who are the leaders of the Republican Party, which is the party of the people. I mean, I guess you'd have to say Jefferson's the ultimate limousine liberal, if you want to understand it. And the Southern planters in general are. It's amazing when you think about it that these planters, without fully realizing what they're dealing with, are the supporters of the most liberal ideas, most radical ideas in the Revolutionary era, because they're not frightened of democracy, because they don't fear it. They never lose elections. They live in a hierarchical world where they're always elected. There's very little contention. It's in the North where you have real democracy emerging, competitive elections, that those are the people frightened, the Federalists who are frightened by democracy. Now, that's a long-winded answer to your question, but the little Enlightenment, of course, is important. But the Enlightenment is not just some thing. It's a bunch of cultural notions. And the science, of course, is very important. Jefferson is very much caught up in this. He's very doubtful of religion. He has contempt for organized religion, something that Adams did not have. And Jefferson, the reason Jefferson makes his Bible, he cuts up the New Testament, because they're accusing him of being anti-Christian in the election of 1800. They called him an atheist. He's not an atheist. But he is a Unitarian, that is, he does not believe in the divinity of Jesus. But he says, I am a real Christian, and so he cuts up the Bible, all of the phrases, he cuts out all the miracles and all that, and he just says, I'm going to focus on what's true to Christianity, love thy neighbor. All of Jesus' statements about love are emphasized in his Bible. And that's what he wants to emphasize, that we all should love one another. We all will love one another if only the government would get out of the way and stop favoring one person, giving titles to some, giving monopolies to others. Let us all just relate to one another naturally. This, you know, can when carried like Godwin, it carried to extreme, it breeds anarchism. And that's William Godwin ends up, he's an English radical, as an anarchist, because he takes this idea very seriously. Well, if government's intervening, let's just get government out of the way and we'll just all love one another. Well, most people don't go that far, but Jefferson doesn't either. But that's where he's coming from, that we have a natural love for one another and that needs to be promoted and allowed to flow freely. If you stop, the government stops giving titles to this person, giving monopolies to that person, then you'll appreciate the natural sociability of people. And it doesn't need education. It's natural to everyone. And that is his dream. Now, however true or false it is, that's the basis for his radicalism in the late 18th century. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.